Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A health trend in marketing the use of young blood plasma transfusions to prevent aging is out there. The Centers for Disease Control issued a warning last month against these services, but many businesses still provide them. Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, Bruce Y. Lee, recently wrote about the issue and why you shouldn't pay for blood from young people to combat aging. We'll post a link to the Forbes piece on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Bruce Y. Lee joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
When did this get to be a thing?
Well, in recent years, we've seen some companies emerge that basically have been offering these blood transfusions from quote-unquote younger folks. The observation that generated some of these businesses is that there has been some experimental evidence that if you connect the blood supplies of mice or rats that you can see some improvements in terms of function, but still there's much that needs to be done before this can be confirmed.
Is the blood of younger people any way demonstrably better than that of older people?
Yeah, so that's not clear. The theory is that there are these factors or certain types of chemicals within younger people's blood that can then quote-unquote regenerate or rejuvenate older people, but the science is not there yet. So a lot of this is going on the theories that were advanced using animal experiments, but a lot of things happen in animals that don't happen in humans.
It's one thing to be taken for your money. It's another thing for the FDA to issue warnings about such things. What are the dangers?
Well, basically, there are dangers of blood transfusion.
Automatically.
That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it if you absolutely need to have a blood transfusion. Mm-hmm. But you are adding extra volume to your body, to your circulation. That can overload your heart, that can overload the circulation in your lungs. You can get an allergic reaction or some type of transfusion reaction. And in some cases, people can get acute injury to their lungs, and that actually can be life-threatening. So you want to be careful. People in controlled settings, like the hospital operating room, when they give blood transfusions, they're very serious about it because they know there might be these side effects, and they're standing on guard, ready to take care of these side effects. So it's a combination of just blood transfusions in general can cause side effects, but also you have to be in the right controlled setting where people can take care of these problems, and that's not clear if you're in some business that's offering this.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Bruce Y. Lee. He's an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He recently wrote about why it's not a good idea to pay for blood from young people to combat aging. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why the warning now? What's the timing of this?
Well, it's because these businesses have emerged. So they've emerged over the past recent years, and they're starting to get more publicity, and people are paying, in some cases, $8,000 or so for a single transfusion. So the FDA became aware of this. And they sat back and said, well, where's the scientific evidence? We're worried about safety issues. So they felt the need to clamp down on it. This has gone around in terms of in Silicon Valley circles, and there's been talk among different social media folks and people who are within the Silicon Valley set of getting these blood transfusions. So the word has gotten out.
What are the companies that are doing this? Who are they? Where'd they come from?
Well, there's a company named Ambrosia, which basically was started by someone who was from Stanford, who got a medical degree, I believe, from Stanford, and that was offering this. Once the FDA warning came out, the company indicated that they have stopped offering these blood transfusions for now. But they also have some registered clinical trials to do that. So that's probably been the most prominent example of a company that's offering these services.
And how much do they cost?
Well, the quoted price that you see is around $8,000 for a blood transfusion. You know, of course, there might be some variability in terms of the actual price, but that's the price that's been going around.
And do we know if this is that popular?
That's hard to say, because then you'd actually have to look at the business records for the different companies that are offering it. So you can't really tell, you know, how many people are actually using the service. But word about it has gotten around. There's been a TED Talk on it. There's been discussions on social media. There was news of Peter Thiel being interested in it. So word has gotten around.
The word's getting around. Is it regulated at all?
That's the issue. That's one of the issues. So, you know, what safety regulations are in place? Well, first of all, like, it shouldn't be done at this point. Like, if you're thinking about it, I would advise against doing it, because, mm-hmm. You know, the safety has not been established. The efficacy has not been established. In other words, you know, does it even do anything beneficial? That's not clear. The science is not there yet. Plus, you're talking about these facilities where you're not sure what kind of safety regulations are in place, whether they're being regularly inspected, you know, where the blood is coming from. You know, that's the other thing. Whenever we talk about blood transfusions, we worry about infectious diseases.
Exactly.
Like hepatitis or HIV.
Mm-hmm.
So how are those being screened, and how can you be sure that the blood is actually safe?
I'm trying to understand, too, this overload issue you brought up earlier. I was a candidate for a transfusion once, but they didn't do it because they thought I could regenerate the blood on my own without taking these risks that you just mentioned. But if you don't need – so I had a blood loss. If you don't need blood to compensate for a blood loss, where does all the blood go?
Well, so your red blood cells are being continuously generated. You know, in your basically, there's a hormone called EPO, which then stimulates your bone marrow to generate more blood cells, and your blood cells are continuously being circulated. And you know, after a period of time, after several months, then you're constantly replacing your sets of blood cells. So if your body is working normally, you should be able to regenerate blood cells. You only have to get a transfusion if either your blood is not generating blood cells regularly enough,
uh-huh.
or you have such a massive loss of blood that you need to replace it quickly, because it takes time to regenerate the blood cells.
Right, right.
So that's why you should avoid transfusions unless you really need them.
Carrie, in Columbus, you're on the air with Bruce Lee of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I had a question. I have had blood drawn from my arm, my own blood, and used, put through a process and used on my face, which has made a tremendous improvement in my face. I wondered if there's a comment about using your own blood for not a transfusion, just a process.
Yeah, that's a process that's being used by some dermatologist. Basically, what happens is you take the blood, you spin it down, and you just isolate parts of the blood and re-inject it into the face. You know, that's received the dubbed name of "quote unquote" vampire facial, because it involves blood. So, it is a procedure that's being used out there. You know, the science is still evolving in terms of you know, what are the potential risks and how effective it is. There's anecdotal evidence that suggests that, you know, people have said they like it, but I think there needs to be more studies to really evaluate how effective it is. The other thing is safety again, because you know you know not all places are the same. Are they taking the right precautions? So you want to be careful.
I have heard of vampire facials, but I don't understand why they're necessary. What's the goal?
Well, the thought is that there are these quote unquote factors or chemicals that have rejuvenating effects. That if you can spin down the blood, you can isolate this and inject them in higher doses or higher quantities within the face. But again, we need more studies and we need more research to really determine, you know, how effective this is.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call. Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. I worked ages ago, back when HIV was still thought maybe to be an HTLV-3, and we screened 5,000 blood donors. I would want to know, what kind of bloodborne pathogens could this blood be carrying? Mm-hmm. How thoroughly is it being screened?
So that's something that you addressed earlier, right, Bruce?
Yes, very good question. You know, again, HIV, hepatitis, there's a variety of different types of hepatitis viruses. So you need to know where the blood's coming from, you know, how it's being screened, what precautions are being taken, how it's being stored, all those different types of things. So, you know, many hospitals have regular inspections to determine that. But if you're going to a place where it's not clear what those regulations are and how it's being monitored, then I would be very careful.
Charlotte, thanks a lot for that question. Is the FDA looking at if they can't stop people from doing it? I mean, is there anything afoot to end this practice at a statute level?
Well, they have indicated their warning against it. So, you know, there's different levels. So many times when the FDA will issue warning, their hope is that businesses will voluntarily suspend their activities, which is what happened, which is what Ambrosia announced. So it remains to be seen what, you know, how many of businesses decide to stop their activities voluntarily. And if that occurs, then the FDA doesn't really have to do anything more. However, if these practices continue, then, you know, they have to be monitored and have to see, you know, what exactly are they doing, you know, what risk they're providing towards the patients, et cetera. So I think it really depends on what happens after this initial warning.
Okay. Well, Bruce Lee, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
No problem, man.
That's Bruce Y. Lee. He's an associate professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He wrote for Forbes recently about why you should not pay for blood from young people to combat aging. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Concentrations of parents in the Northwest U.S. have opted against having their children vaccinated for measles. Their inaction has led to outbreaks in, among other places, Washington State, where a state of emergency has been declared. For most, measles is a matter of a fever and a rash. For others, the infection can become systemic and attack the brain. Today, we're talking about measles, the risks, and prevention. Joining us now is Professor of Pediatrics at Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine, Dr. Alice Ackerman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. How are you? I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. What is measles? I got them when I was a kid. And I remember when my mother got them from me, she was a lot sicker than I was.
Yeah, I bet she was. So measles is a virus. Therefore, it is not treatable with antibiotics, as a recent person in the government has tried to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a viral infection. It is an acute viral infection. Generally starts, as you've been saying in your little intro, with a fever and cough, a runny nose, and conjunctivitis, which is like pink eye.
Mm-hmm.
And then it progresses to a rash that starts on the face and moves down the body and moves from the trunk to the extremities, the arms and legs. About 1 in 20 people who get measles will end up getting one of the most common complications, which is pneumonia. And although we do think about measles as a self-limited disease of childhood, actually about 1 in 4 cases of measles end up having to be hospitalized because of either the pneumonia or one of the other common complications, which include diarrhea. So some patients will end up getting dehydrated and need to go in the hospital for that. There is also a less common but very severe complication called encephalitis. And that happens in about 1 in 1,000 people who had measles, who acutely have measles, where the virus basically attacks the brain, and that can almost certainly lead to the need for hospitalization, can lead to seizures or, you know, patients having convulsions, and can be fatal in a number of cases. About 1 to 2 out of every 1,000 individuals with measles will die. So that's really a pretty high death rate, and makes measles, it's one of the reasons that measles was on the list of diseases that we wanted to eradicate with development of vaccines.
You know, obviously I've dated myself. I'm pre-vaccine era because I got all the other ones. But, you know, a lot of times people just don't remember what it was like back in the day before vaccines.
Absolutely. And it's so I was born in the pre-vaccine era for measles, but I was lucky enough that I didn't get it as a young child. And actually, when the vaccine came out in 1963, my physician was forward-thinking enough to say, hey, you need to get this. Even though you're above the age where most people get measles, if you get it as an older person, you're really going to be suffering.
Why is it different in older people than younger people, all things being equal? Why did my mom get so much sicker than I did? Is it an age thing?
I don't really. There's actually the evidence says that the people who tend to be sickest are the very youngest children. So it's less than a year of age because they generally haven't been immunized. And after about 6 months, they have no immunity left from their parent, from their mom. But I think that older people just don't tolerate the high fever because it usually comes with a pretty high fever, close to, you know, usually between 103 and 104. And I think the older you are, you certainly don't tolerate that. And you can get dehydrated a little easier just from the fever and you feel so bad. Whereas when you're a child, you may not really, you know, your parent or whoever is caring for you is doing that. And I think you just don't really process it as that sick. The data actually supports that the younger people are the ones that are most at risk for getting the complications.
In Washington state, they've declared a state of emergency. A lot of people from the outside looking in on that think, well, there's just a few dozen people who are sick from measles. Why a state of emergency?
Well, measles is one of the most contagious viral diseases that we know of. It's spread. Most viruses require absolutely direct contact. I have to, you know, if I have the flu and I want to get you infected, I basically have to cough or sneeze within about 18 inches of where you are for the flu virus to then get into your nasal passages. And a relatively low number of people who have that direct contact are actually going to get infected. Measles will infect over 95% of people who don't have immunity, so they don't have antibodies. And the virus can remain for up to 2 hours in an area. And so you could be walking through an area where if I was contagious from measles, and I might not always know I have it at the time that I'm contagious, and we can talk about that. But if I was coughing and sneezing, you might actually walk through up to 2 hours later and be able to be infected. And so if you're susceptible, so you haven't either had the disease before or you haven't had a good response to the immunization, you are very, very likely to get it. And that's why it's different from many of the other viruses that that we worry about. because it can spread so rapidly, and the complications are significant.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the outbreak of measles in the Northwest part of the nation. My guest is Dr. Alice Ackerman. She's a professor of pediatrics at Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. If you have a question or comment about the measles, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So parents who choose not to have their children vaccinated for measles typically don't have their children vaccinated at all. They're opposed to vaccinations for one reason or another. But if they think that they can protect their child by isolating them, you're suggesting that it's much tougher with measles because you don't know who's been in some place. You know, you could be shopping. You don't know who touched that lemon in the grocery store before you did.
Absolutely. And so we've seen a lot of situations in which you know, somebody was on an airplane and didn't know that they were sick. You know, maybe they just had a little cough. I know when I was traveling a few weeks ago, everybody in the area around me was coughing. And so you're not going to think anything of it. And then you might find out 4 or 5 days later when that person breaks out in the rash that, oh, you were on an airplane where there was somebody who was incubating measles and they were contagious at that point. So it's very hard to know. It's very hard to keep your child safe unless you really keep them, you know, in your house and you don't allow any visitors ever. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. So immunization is really the only tried and true method that we have for preventing this disease.
We've talked many times on the show about the herd that, you know, it may not be about you getting vaccinated from something for something. It's more about protecting people who can't get vaccinated. Why are some people not able to get vaccinated?
Well, there's a number of reasons. One is very young children who may not have a good enough immune response to the vaccination. So for measles, those are children less than the age of 12 months, don't usually have a long-lasting response. They can get the shot if they're above 6 months but less than 12 in the throes of an outbreak. But otherwise, it's people with immune deficiencies. So children with cancer, for instance, are the biggest group of individuals who can't get immunized while they're undergoing chemotherapy or while they have an acute leukemia because the measles is actually what we call a live attenuated vaccine. So it's a real live virus, but it's been changed in so that it doesn't typically cause a significant disease in the person that gets it. You might get a little rash, you might get a low-grade fever, but you don't get measles and you're not contagious.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, but children who have an absent or a very diminished immune response because they're on chemotherapy or people with HIV/AIDS or some children that are inborn with immune deficiencies, they won't make a good response to the vaccine, and there is more of a risk that it could hurt them. So we don't give it to those patients, and they are the ones that you're protecting in addition to yourself by having the herd immunity there.
Let's see. Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello. A question your guest might have an insight on that's disturbing to me. And I'll make the analogy to the issue of guns. It tends to be either an all or nothing. There's a crowd that basically implies that all vaccinations are always wrong at all times. And there's others that sort of act like cheerleaders for them. They're always good all the time, no side effects. And it seems to me the truth is somewhere in the middle, that vaccines are generally or most often helpful, but there are downsides. There are risks. They need to be acknowledged and evaluated. And I'm wondering why there can't be a reasoned dialogue on this rather than just the name calling. And they'll take that off the air if you wish.
Is there a middle ground for you, Dr. Ackerman?
Well, you know, my goal, and I have spent most of my life practicing as a pediatric intensivist. So I've seen the sickest of the sick. I've seen babies die from pertussis. I've seen children suffer a very rare complication of measles called SSTE, which happens 7 to 10 years after you think you're in the clear, after you've had the virus infection, and this comes back and invariably causes death and disability. So I am, you know, I'm on the side that says I really want to see people get vaccinated against diseases that we can prevent, especially those that cause horrible or can cause horrible complications. But I do understand, as Mark was saying, you know, parents, by and large, only want to do the right thing for their child. And they're trying to make the best educated decision that they can make. A number of years ago here in Virginia, I held some vaccine town halls where I invited some speakers and some parents, whoever wanted to come and talk about vaccines. And one of the things that we learned was that typically physicians, pediatricians, or general practitioners will say, oh, it's time for Susie to get, you know, her vaccines. And if the parent says, well, I'm not so sure, what we were hearing from parents is a lot of the doctors would say, oh, you don't want vaccines? You're either fired from my practice or, okay, fine. And there wasn't a lot of dialogue going on. And so I agree with Mark. We need an open and clear dialogue about the issues. Every child is different. There may be some kids that have certain risk factors for certain vaccines, and they shouldn't be necessarily treated as all or nothing. Also, what we need to recognize is when the study, most of the studies that have been done looking at vaccine safety have looked at them given in the specific order and combinations that are generally being recommended. So we may not have any evidence if you follow a different kind of schedule that it's actually going to be effective or as effective as doing it the way it's recommended, because those are generally the ways that the vaccines have been tested and evaluated. Don't know if that fully answered the question, but, you know, yeah, I don't think that everybody that says I don't want a vaccine for my child is bad or evil. Mm-hmm. I do think that they, you know, maybe they need a little more information. Maybe they need us to sit down and say, here's, you know, here's what I recommend and here's why. You know, and treat it as any other medical treatment that, that we would discuss the pros and cons of.
Eric in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Alice Ackerman from the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. Hi, Eric.
Hi, good morning. I had a question. We were talking about measles earlier. The measles vaccine is typically the given through the MMR vaccine, right, which is measles, mumps, and rubella. I was just wondering why that vaccine is given as a combination of those three, and then also why we haven't seen an uptick in outbreaks, or if we have seen an uptick in outbreaks with mumps and rubella in combination.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. Dr. Ackerman?
Yeah. So, Eric, I think that that is interesting. And I think the reason is that the measles is no longer available as a separate vaccination. I don't remember exactly when that stopped, but it's been within the last couple of years. And I think that's really because it is recommended that the measles, mumps, and rubella be given at about the same time. It is also now available in combination with the varicella or chickenpox vaccine, MMRV. And the real reason for that is so that the children don't have to be stuck multiple times It makes it easier on the child. It, you know, it might make it a little harder to assess if there is a, you know, a negative response of some sort, what component is related to that. But I think that all of the recent studies have looked at measles vaccine have actually looked at it given as the MMR. And there was just a big nationwide study out of Denmark that got published on Monday at the Annals of Internal Medicine, where they looked at a huge number of children, over 600,000 children, followed them. In Denmark, it's easy to do, and they could follow individual children and were able to show with the MMR as the as the form of measles vaccination, that there was no association at all with development of autism, which, of course, is the thing that most people are afraid of.
Right. You know, there was a mumps outbreak in central Ohio a few years back, by the way. Mm-hmm. Do the mumps occur at different times of the year, the measles, or is it a 24/7, 365 kind of a thing?
Yeah, mumps is much more rare and is much harder to transmit. And so there's not really, as far as I know, a real association with time of the year.
Let's see. Linda in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Linda.
Yes, good morning. I've just got a comment for you. I had measles when I was a child. I had them because that vaccine was not available.
Mm-hmm.
I'm old enough that I certainly remember how horrible that was. I grew up in a rural county, and, you know, a little girl just in the next little town over, my age, died of measles. Mm-hmm. And parents lined up to get that vaccine as soon as it became available. Everybody on the mountain knew that that child had died and why. You know, and another thing, a woman that I knew pretty well growing up was developmentally disabled. And the reason given was that her mother was pregnant with her when she, the mother, got rubella.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these things used to be very common. And I think these people who are not opting for vaccinations are in such error or denial or something. These childhood diseases are awful. They're really awful. Mm-hmm. They're dangerous. They're not just uncomfortable for a few days. They can be horribly dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I really just think that parents are very misguided to put their faith in what they might read on the internet instead of what a medical professional might tell them. It's just very distressing to me that people seem to have some choice over whether to do this or not.
That is, Linda in Worthington, thank you so much for that. That is another issue for another day, the issue of choice. But for now, Dr. Ackerman, thank you so much for your time.
Well, you're quite welcome, and I hope that we were able to answer some of the questions on your listeners' minds.
It's Dr. Alice Ackerman. She's professor of pediatrics at Virginia Tech Carolian School of Medicine. We're moving on with more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you are over 50, forgetting a name or losing a key is more than an inconvenience. It raises the question about dementia. About 6 million Americans have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and early detection can help. Testing for this sort of decline is Time-consuming and complicated, but researchers at Ohio State developed an assessment. It's called the SAGE test, and it requires a pencil, a piece of paper, in about 15 minutes. In the past 5 years, nearly 2 million people have downloaded the test. Joining us now is the director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology at the OSU Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Douglas Shari. Dr. Shari developed the test with his research team, and I want to welcome you back to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
2 million people later, right? I mean, what a difference a couple years makes. Did you expect that kind of response?
I did not. And it really goes to the point that there's a gap in people that have a real need and want to find out about their brain health, their cognitive health, and perhaps they're not getting it from their primary care doctor or others. Don't give them enough latitude to sort of chart their own way through their health care and their own health. So I think it's a testament to the need that's out there and still needs to be sort of advertised for people to use it as a tool for them to help with their health.
Walk us through the test, would you, and tell us what it takes to do it and what you're looking for.
Sure. So the whole idea, of course, came because people were coming in much too late, either because of decreased insight or embarrassment. And doctors often would not just ask about cognitive health. They're getting older. It's a common condition of aging. So we wanted to try to identify people early because the treatments work much better the earlier you start them. So I devised a test that's self-administered. That's the first two letters in SAGE. Self-administered gerocognitive examination, and it was designed to make things easier, so you didn't need an administrator. You could do it at the doctor's office. You could even do it at home and take it into your doctor's office, and it contains a variety of – it's a cognitive test, a pen and paper test, and it measures a variety of domains, memory and visual, spatial, and language, and calculations, and problem solving. This sort of reflects the whole area of the brain and gives it some point value, so you can say, okay, I'm still thinking quite normally. I don't have to be too worried about this. Or there's a change, especially if you measure over time, or I'm having a lot of problems, and these are certainly things that I should be talking to my primary care doctor about.
How did your research boil it down to a 15-minute test this way?
Well, it took a lot of research and a lot of testing. Probably took at least 5 years to do this, even though it seems like a simple test. So we had to get questions that were identifiable for people with early stage. So the test couldn't be too hard because the majority of people, wouldn't understand it, and it couldn't be too easy, and everyone would pass it. So we knew what the usual, areas where you first start having problems in visual spatial issues, naming things, memory, problem solving. And we tested a lot of different possibilities and found ones that really worked well for this. And we have four different forms, which are equivalent, which also was difficult. We measured we took the scoring to make sure that it wasn't just overrepresenting your score, overrepresenting memory function, for example, so that it fairly represented a global cognitive ability of your brain. So about the same amount for frontal areas as well as temporal or parietal or posterior parts of the brain. And so it was a complex feature, a complex task. And then we had validity testing on it to neuropsychological tests. These are sort of the gold standard lengthy tests that measure cognitive functioning. And it turned out that we did a pretty darn good job at it, became very successful, and it's being used all over the world. And in fact, we have now a digital form of the same test.
What? How much of the data is useful to you from the 2 million plus that have taken the test?
So they don't get back to me. Okay. They can download it. It's the SAGE test is free. It's always going to be free. They can download it. It's a pen and paper. And then what they do with it, I have no idea. We tell them, please take it to your doctor. Even if you do great on it, it's a good baseline. And we know that if we measure people over time, say you're an older individual and maybe at risk for cognitive impairment or dementia, that this test will pick up at least 6 months earlier than the most other common cognitive test that we have out there that doctors typically use, called the mini mental state. So, and it's not needed to be administered, so you don't need a nurse or a doctor or a medical assistant. You can do it on your own. Doesn't take physicians' time, so that it can be repeated fairly easily.
Are you interested in finding out who are these 2 million people? Not necessarily their names, but their demographics, that kind of a thing.
Of course. And so we're moving with that actually in terms of the in the digital world. So we can capture the data. It's called brain test. It's the digital form of SAGE. And so it can actually capture whatever they may want to put into the file. So if they want to provide more information about their health, not necessarily their name, but, you know, do they have family history? Do they have health issues? So we're developing those types of things. We're going to be placing it into our electronic medical record, for example, at Ohio State. That's still a work in progress, so that doctors can use it at the point of service, and that it gets scored automatically and it gets automatically put into the medical file, so it's easy to access.
We will post a link to the SAGE test on our website at wosu.org/allsides. My guest is Dr. Douglas Shari. He's director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. He and his crew developed this test a few years ago, and since then, nearly 2 million people have downloaded the test. More are taking it every day. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Shari, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'd love to hear from people who have taken the test and get some feedback from you about what you thought about it. I mean, what kind of feedback do you get about the test, Dr. Shari?
One of the best feedbacks from it is relief, so that an individual may take it. They may be just a little bit worried about their cognitive issues, their aging. It's nothing really severe, and they take the test. They score really well. And there's a lot of relief saying, okay, I guess maybe I'm doing okay for now, and I can recheck myself over the years. So it helps individuals feel better. And the other big thing is that it's since it's self-administered, it's less imposing than when you come into your doctor or someone's giving you a test and sitting right in front of you and asking you, what's this, and memorize this and do this. So they feel a little easier about taking it. There's not as much angst. It's an easier type of thing. They can go back, take as much time as they want with it. When they're ready, they turn it in. So all of those things, I think, are probably the most positive features of it.
Have you heard from physicians?
Absolutely. So one of the two things that they say is, first is, helps to tell that the worried well, so to call, are still okay and don't worry about it. And number two, the individuals who don't want to come in, don't want to announce that they have some cognitive issues, it identifies those people really early. So you're saving a lot of healthcare dollars by not doing expensive tests on the people who really don't need it because score well on this test. And you are looking at some diagnostic tests on people that aren't scoring well, which is where you really need to find them earlier, which, again, will save healthcare dollars.
Over the past few years, have you wanted to change up the test at all? Are there any tweaks?
So the first tweak, really it works surprisingly well, and it held up over time. We've measured people over 7 years. There's a lot of data that we have right now. It's being used in clinics now in all over Europe and the world. There's a famous Alzheimer's researcher in Paris, France, that has translated to French and is going to use it in his clinics, and we're going to try to make a bigger spread across different languages and different cultures in Europe. So a lot of researchers, which is very heartening to me, that like myself are in this field, have found that this is a very useful test, and we have, you know, research validity behind it to mm-hmm. suggest that, yes, it does what it purports to do.
What about the differences from doing it online than the difference between doing it online and doing it on a piece of paper? Are you expecting any differences?
So we did a study with that, just published that about a year ago, and yes, we had to. You can't just assume that a paper form is the same as a digital form. And in mm-hmm. fact, what we found was about 50% of our subjects in that study had never used a smartphone, had never used a tablet. and about 50% had. And those that hadn't used the technology scored about a point lower than those that didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And also we found that in general, people score maybe a little bit about a point lower on the digital test and the paper test for these variety of reasons. Fortunately, there was not a scale bias. In other words, if you were really did well on the test, you scored a point less. And if you really did poorly on the test, you also scored a point less. So it was just a scalar factor that we can then take it, whether you had the paper test or the digital test, we can make equivalent scores with them just by adding a point.
Are the contents of the test generational? In other words, when the millennials today are over 50 years old and become candidates for this test, would the test change to reflect their reality?
I think over time we'd like to adjust and make adjustments with it as needed. Right now it seems to be working well. The only thing that typically the younger generation tends to miss more than anything else is the clock drawing and putting the hands in correctly.
Mm-hmm.
They can draw a clock and put in the numbers, but it's a minor part of the test. You might miss one extra point or something, which is usually within a point is within the error of the test. So, and I think the analog clocks, I think, are still going to be very, very popular, and I don't think that's going to really go out of vogue. All the other tests that we do, things like memory and naming and visual spatial problem solving, those are going to be universal cognitive functions that will not need much tweaking, I don't think.
Hmm. And as far as the research goes, I'm kind of wondering about for people who have parents or loved ones who are in this age group and they want to find out, do you have any recommendations for how they can get their parents to take this kind of a test?
So, you know, they can just go onto the website and
print it out.
Google Sage test, print it out. They can get their parents to take it. So oftentimes I just go up and say that the parent may or may not want to. It depends on your approach. As
mm-hmm.
always, the doctor may have trouble with patients as well. Usually you come into a doctor's office and they say, here, do this, get a blood test, do something. Okay, I don't like it, but I'll do this thing. And so that maybe pushed them a little more. So we're trying to get it more and more into doctor's offices as well. But the very important thing is even if, two things I should say. One is the test is also being used, you know, like before and after, say, chemotherapy or a drug a change in medications perhaps, or before and after surgery. So doctors can get a sense as to is procedure X or treatment Y impacting on their cognitive abilities. So, and dialysis patients and a whole host of different things is being used at. And the second thing is, even if you find mild cognitive issues, even without giving medications or changing, it helps with increased supervision. So if you know mom has declined a little bit, you might want to just double check her medications if she's still living by herself. And you might want to check over the finances and make sure that she has advanced directives in place and that she's taking her other pills correctly so mm-hmm. that she doesn't have poor judgment with the medication use or symptom reporting or her driving or being taken advantage of, those types of things.
Dr. Douglas Shari, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it as always.
All right, thank you.
Dr. Douglas Shari, Director of the Division of Cognitive Neurology at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for your attention. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.